Talk given Saturday, 9th October, 1971.
At our last meeting, we considered our attitude towards the body. How, in the ordinary way, we have a sense of ownership over it, proprietorship. And we tried to see how that sense of ownership was bound up with vanity, with egoism, with indulgence, and all the consequences of indulgence, with resentment if indulgence and the desire to indulge was frustrated, and so on. And we also try to see how, when this sense of ownership disappears, because we see through it and see that it is altogether false, it gives place to a sense of trusteeship. We are the trustees of our own bodies, not the owners. And in that sense of trusteeship, there is every chance of right action where the body is concerned and where our life in the physical world of affairs is concerned. Now, today, we might look similarly at what we call the mind. We all use the phrase, my mind, his mind. Talk of a brilliant mind, a dull mind, and so forth, as characterizing some particular person. Have I really got a mind which is my own? Is there any such thing? Or is that phrase, my mind, just a mistaken way of naming the mental processes that are observable in any living being? This is a very important question. In certain ways, much more important, and of course, far more difficult to investigate than what is implied in the phrase, my body. You remember, we saw the impermanence of that which composes what is commonly called my body. The elements making up my body are elements which are the common stuff of the world as a whole. That out of the world these elements emerge, they are taken in into what is this particular organism, and there is a continuous changing process in which those same elements in some form or other are given out again. We can't hold the body as our own property in the same way that we may be owners of a house or some inanimate physical object that, relatively to us, doesn't undergo change in the same way. The house, or if you like, your piano or your something which lasts a very long time, remains relatively stable, relatively identifiable. This is the particular house. There it is, you see. This particular house in which we are at the moment is now about 100 years old. It's older than myself. It is a bit absurd to call myself the owner of the house. But that is our human convention, is it not? However, with regard to a physical object, to assert ownership has more substantial reality to it than with respect to what we call our thoughts and feelings, our character, and so forth. How much substantial ownership, stability is there in our thoughts? They arise, they vanish. Sometimes they never arise in fullness. They hardly formulate themselves completely before they have gone. Then there is the whole host of beliefs, of ideas and conceptions which we hold. And we identify ourselves with those beliefs and ideas and conceptions. And say, these are my thoughts, my beliefs, my firm convictions. What exactly is this firm conviction, this belief? Is it not a string of words? In itself, is it an objective reality? We need not deny the tremendous power of the beliefs and convictions, because the whole world has been moved, driven by beliefs and convictions, still is moved and driven by them, and will continue in that same fashion for many an eon of time. But how substantial a reality is a belief or a conviction? How substantial is this thing which we call my mind? I'm not questioning the reality of mind. What we are trying to see is the reality, if there is any reality involved in the phrase my mind, or his mind, or your mind. If there is substantial reality in my beliefs and ideas, my thoughts as they arise, my feelings as they arise, my character as it is, as it was, and so forth, would it be likely that they would undergo change? Compare the body, for instance, as far as this body, which is called Firoz Mehta, is concerned, the bones are more or less going to remain like that for his lifetime. There'll be changes in the other parts of the body which are slower or swifter according to the material state of those parts, whether liquid or gaseous, as the case may be. The bones being so solid are the slowest to change. But the rest undergoes continuous change, doesn't it? Now, is there anything in my mind as such which is comparable in solidity to my bones? We have to consider this fact of continuous change which takes place in our mental life, Because our mental life specifically distinguishes us from other kingdoms of nature. The animals are very much like us where the ordinary bodily life is concerned. They have to eat, they have to drink, they have to sleep, and all the rest of it, just like human bodies do. But their mental life is something which is utterly different from ours. Now, just let's try and feel this thing out very, very clearly. There are people who say they have unalterable convictions. This is the truth, the absolute truth. It may be the string of words which represent the teachings of some great teacher, a Buddha or a Jesus. This is the unalterable truth forever and ever. Supposing I hold those ideas when I am 10 years of age. And supposing I hold those ideas, as I say, at 60 years of age. What exactly am I holding? Now follow this very carefully. I am holding fast to the same string of words, but I am ignorant of the fact that in my own consciousness, in my own awareness of the significance, the meaning, the richness or poverty of the content which those words are concerned with, has undergone considerable change, if not complete change. We must appreciate this point very carefully. Just as the body undergoes continuous change, there is a change in the mental part of our nature. Continuous change. And the change is very much greater than bodily change. Let us take it just as a, for the sake of a simple example. Supposing when we are very young, we were told about the law of karma, as we call it. We have certain ideas about it, the law of karma. We have a certain string of words which will represent that law of karma. Does that string of words will remain the same at 60 years of age? But what about my interpretation, my understanding of the law of karma? Although I use the same words again and again, has it not undergone tremendous change? If by any chance it has not undergone change, then I might just as well be dead. I'm just like a block of stupidity, which perhaps I am. So now, what is this thing which I call my mind? Where is it? What is it? You see the importance of this. People live in accordance with their ideas, their beliefs, And their ideas and beliefs are very intimately tied up with their desires. And their desires are always self-oriented. Even the so-called altruistic drives and desires. When I desire to do something not for my benefit, as I say, sincerely and piously and falsely, inaccurately that means, you see, when I say that I desire to do this for the sake of the family, society, for the country, for mankind, for God, for the Master, and all the rest of it, what am I actually doing there? I am identifying myself with the larger whole. That is all. And implanting my desire upon the whole. Supposing God desired something quite different from what I desire in the name of God. I don't know anything about it. He never tells me, you see. He lets me just get along, blunder along. We know only too unhappily from history that some of the most terrible things man has done, he has done not in the name of himself as the individual person, but in the name of the larger whole, be it country or be it the abstract value of honor, justice, freedom and all the rest of it, or be it in the name of God. So you see, this self-identification is the thing with the larger whole is only a means for imposing one's own desire upon the environment. And if beliefs and convictions are so intimately tied up with desire, and the one is subservient to the other, we are spending our life energy not in the best possible way, not in a human way. There is no fulfillment through each individual man of that which manhood stands for. And this is tied up, very intimately tied up, with this illusion that we have and which we name my mind. When we talk of purifying my mind, haven't I already a preconception of what the state of the purified mind is like? But is not this preconception the product of the impure mind? Then can that preconception be a right preconception? You see what is involved in this? The denial of our livingness. That which is living grows by virtue of the power of life within it. And this life and its power is a mystery. I don't know it. This is the fact. It works. What I can know and can discover is the way in which I obstruct it, the way in which I spoil it. This is why I do not come to fruition. I must let the organism and all that the organism stands for, I must let it come to fruition, not hinder it, not obstruct it. And this is the meaning of wisdom. And how different is this wisdom from acquired knowledge? We have any number of people pouring out knowledge. 100 facts for 1 new pence. All of which are supposed to be for one's benefit and fulfillment and happiness and all the rest of it. Is it not folly and exploitation all along the line? I don't like to use the word think. Try to sort of be aware of the truth, the reality underlying all this. We are deluded and misled by others as well as by ourselves. This is our difficulty all along the line. We cannot grow naturally. And in this respect, the other kingdoms of nature have a great advantage over us. They are blessed with the absence of the power of choice. We are blasted with it. But it looks as if we humans need blasting in that way, through our power of choice, in order to awaken to the fact that we have to become choiceless. When we are knowingly choiceless, the mystery will come out through us in terms of unconscious knowledge, pure wisdom. It will just naturally flow out. And when that happens, oneself, the living human individual, has come to fruition. But for that to happen, this thing which I call my mind has to be out of the picture. It's not that mind will be out of the picture. On the contrary, mind will come to its supreme fulfillment and perfect consummation. But this block, this blot, this hindrance, this poisoning source, my mind, will be out of it. Feel it another way. What is ownership but an expression of greed? With all ownership, there are rights affirmed. There is protection needed for that which one owns. And protection means one against another. Otherwise the word protection has no meaning at all. My property, not yours. Obviously. If there is no greed whatsoever, there is complete resilience of mind, a resilience in which the fullness of relationship between work, we commonly call ourself, and everyone else is present. The fullness of relationship is present. And in the fullness of relationship, there is always that kind of participation which is communion in the finest sense, which is the true meaning of sharing. We can establish ownership over a house, over various implements you may use, and so on. Can we establish ownership over light? Over the air which we breathe? Over the space which contains us? But these are the things that are the sources of our very existence, our life, aren't they? And where they are concerned, we have no ownership whatsoever. So you see, this sense of ownership, property, is associated, is rooted in greed. And just as with the body, once that illusion of ownership is out, one awakens to trusteeship. Similarly, there is trusteeship with regard to thoughts, feelings, beliefs, ideas, and so forth. Ideas we will constantly throw out, because as long as we are alive, it's in the nature of the living organism to express its awareness of the environment in terms of thought and feeling and ideas. We can't avoid it. It's perfectly natural. This is the actual process as such. One investigates something, and as a result of the investigating, as a result of discovering something in relation to it, the expression of that discovery is in terms of ideas, in terms of thought. But the moment we try to exert copyright, ownership over the thought and the idea, then we are caught. We are bound by it. If we want to assert ownership over ideas, then reciprocally it is our duty never to change those ideas. What do we do then if we discover that those ideas are imperfect or foolish or false after all? Stick to them? Supposing I buy half a dozen eggs. On breaking them, I discover that they are rotten. Do I compel myself to eat them because I paid the money for them? But supposing we didn't have this sense of ownership, how resilient the mind would be. How free it would be. Of course, one might say, yes, but aren't you advocating also inconstancy? Are Is this a case of inconstancy? If you discover that the idea which you had 10 years, 20 years, 50 years ago is inadequate, is imperfect, is false, are you going to bind yourself by the word inconstancy to hold on to that which is false? A scientist, a philosopher, or people who are called thinkers, they produce something in their young days. Do they stick fast to just those ideas? Don't they change them? As they get more mature? And after all, isn't that right and proper? Because if they don't, there is no growth. If there is then true resiliency of mind, that one does, because of which one does not hold on to that which one discovers is inadequate or untrue, if one has that sort of resiliency, then simultaneously one is much less, if not altogether free from, conflict with one's neighbor who has different ideas from ours. You see the implications of all this. How much influence it has upon human relationships. We talk, for instance, about cultivating friendliness, loving kindness, good fellowship. Standing by the side, you see, working for your party and all the rest of it. We talk in those terms. But what a tremendous amount of fixation is involved in those terms. And how much has this fixation to do with promoting real understanding and real loving kindness and friendliness? If I'm free of the illusion of ownership or property over my mind, then if my neighbor presents ideas, beliefs which are different from mine, I don't take sides with myself against him because my ideas are different. And if I don't take sides with myself against him, I'm not in conflict with him. This is not a case of peace at any price. This is a case where there is a golden opportunity for understanding the reality of things and for discovering truth. If I take sides, I'm already committed. I'm committed to the state of contradicting my neighbor. How then can I ever understand just exactly what my neighbor wants to put forth? True understanding depends upon taking no sides. And taking no sides is possible if there is no possessive sense within one with respect to anything. When that possessiveness is absent, the isolative self is no more. There is only the total reality, the whole reality, and one's attention can be given freely, wholly, to the examination and understanding of that total reality. Try and work this out for yourself, if you feel inclined, in relation to international events. One country does this, the other country has to retaliate. Peace on earth, goodwill to man. How can we have it? So if this which I call my mind, this illusion of my mind is out of the way, then the illusion of separate selfhood also is out of the way. Because my body and my mind can be associated only with the separate self. Isn't that the case? It is the fact that each living organism called a human being represents a recognizable, identifiable person distinct from other such persons. We quite agree on that. That is a fact. Each one of us is self-conscious and has to be self-conscious to the extent that he does not meet with an accident personally, to the extent that he does not interfere with others, and so forth. But when he goes still further and isolates himself from the whole, then self-consciousness has gone wrong. It has become an isolative self-consciousness. It has become a block to true awareness. Now, in terms of isolated self-consciousness, one feels and thinks and acts in terms of my body, my mind. In terms of true awareness, one just knows that there is but one total reality manifesting itself in innumerable, unique ways through each and every individual. Now, how then do we view the fact that ideas will emerge in us, whoever we are, at whatever stage we are? Whether I am an ignorant, foolish, troublesome person, or whether I am an enlightened Buddha, or a Christ who is the Savior, Redeemer and Savior of man, and so forth. What is the difference? Ideas emerge from both. But he who has realized is fully awake to the fact that it is the one total reality which has produced this idea through him. Whereas the ignorant person says, oh, my idea. Now, this is not a question of mere saying. That is to say, it is not a question of knowing this fact intellectually and then just saying the words, oh no, these are not my ideas, this is the one total reality functioning through me. One can easily do that and fool oneself that, I'm free, I'm liberated, I'm the holy one now. Not at all. It has to grow into a real awareness. And whatsoever grows into real awareness becomes second nature to that person. So that unselfconsciously, it just naturally functions through him. There is no conflict, no struggle involved anymore. He is like that. He can do it. You take a healthy youngster, 12, 14, 16, he can easily take a run and jump 4 feet, maybe 5 feet up in the air, right over the hurdle. I can't do that anymore. I've passed that stage. For that youngster, it is second nature. It's perfectly natural. He just jumps like that because he is like that. Now, similarly, with enlightenment, with true understanding, with true growth, which is the fulfillment of the human in us, all that becomes second nature. We are just naturally like that. And if we experience any inward struggle rising up, if we are caught napping in our daily life with respect to this assertion of ownership and proprietorship and all the rest of it, it means that it is only a string of words in our mind which we hold, that it is the one total reality that is throwing out this idea through this organism. The Holy One does not know that he is the Holy One. He just is the Holy One. It's the same with the Realized One. He does not know it in the manner in which the man of the world knows. As men of the world, we know in this fashion, I, the separate subject, know that the separate object or person. And that knowing is the knowing which exists in the state of duality, not in the state of communion, where relationship is total and complete and whole. And that is the state of holiness. But the Holy One's knowledge is not an analytical synthetic knowledge. It is knowledge which is actually being that which he knows. And when one is what one knows, all conflict, all non-humanness is out. This is the fulfillment of humanity. This is the human really come to flower as human, the happy thinker. Thinker in the sense of creator. Then my mind is totally non-existent. There is only mind, universal mind, this mysterious unknown energy. which is functioning unobstructed freely through that living person. During the last 3 or 4 years, we have considered mind, or rather, I have suggested that it is helpful to approach the understanding of mind in terms of the receptive, responsive sensitivity which characterizes each living person. This is one side of the story. The personal side, if you like. The sensitivity which characterizes each living person. That is this other side. Mind as power, as energy. And mind as power or energy is universal. It's not personal. It's not particularized. Just as space is universal, so too mind is universal. And it is only out of ignorance that I use live in terms of concepts such as my mind. All that in me which makes for this which I term my mind is the dross. The pure gold is mind, the totality, the universal thing, which is not known analytically by me, never can be known analytically. If one really penetrates into this, really sees it, there comes extraordinary freedom. One just has to experience it. It is there. There is peace. Then peace is there. Peace of mind is not peace of my mind. Never can be. Peace of mind is the peace that passes all understanding, all analytical knowledge, all objective perception. And that belongs to that mystery, the totality, which is named mind. Therefore, there can be no such thing as seeking peace of mind. As I've said so often, go out and seek space. Now, we all are sufficiently enlightened to know that we can't do it and we don't need to do it. It is here. That universal reality, which is space, is known to all of us. You tell a little child, go and find a bit of space, and if he is sort of on the alert, he will. If he is very well brought up, he won't tell me, oh, don't be so silly. But he knows that I'm being silly, telling him to go and find space. You haven't got to find it, it is here. Peace of mind is like that, it is here. What brings turmoil into it? My mind. The owner, the possessor. The fellow who is throwing out thoughts and ideas and all the rest of it and claiming copyright over them. Does this make for difficulty? all the cherished beliefs and convictions, all that we have labored through years and years to achieve and make us feel, ah, at last I have got the truth. This is where I found it. Such and such a book, such and such a teacher, such and such an experience, such and such an event. What extraordinary illusions. And you know, if we live in a cocoon, keeping ourselves comfortable, insensitive to the actual reality which is continuously present here now throughout our lives, then at the moment of death we will know our full hell, which is the punishment for such illusions. Please don't take this as an awful threat. But it's a fact. You see, at the moment of death, suddenly the whole thing stands there. Good and bad alike. The common garden concepts of reward, punishment, pleasure, pain, they all function in that flash, suddenly. Don't get frightened. You won't be good in any case. See, freedom. Here, at the start, as Krishnamurti says, for instance. It's right here. No seeking it. Relinquish, let go, renounce everything. And that relinquishment takes place only in one way. It is right within the deeps of consciousness, of awareness. It is not as if you have to give away your possessions, your property, your clothes, your money, or anything like that. It's not that. It's not the external things that one has to give away. It is not even aspects of the routine of our daily life which we have to forego. For this relinquishment and renunciation I'm talking of, it is right in the deeps of awareness that the holding on in terms of I, a separate self, possessing this, that's out. That supreme relinquishment completely transforms one's entire relationship with the total environment. This is the great thing. It is a transformation of awareness, is it not? That's what it comes to all along the line. And through this transformation, there emerges fulfillment and fruition. Not my fulfillment and fruition in any possessive sense, but fulfillment and fruition of the one total reality through this particular living organism. That is all. In a sense, this is implied in those words of Jesus, "Thy will, not mine." The whole Hindu-Buddhist teaching of desirelessness hinges around this. Right in the innermost depths of consciousness, you wake up. No more my body, my mind. You know how this came to be known in the world? When the holy ones of the past entered the deep states of consciousness in meditation, they went through the process of the complete denudation of the mind. They saw that all their ideas, their beliefs, their states of mind for the time being and so forth, were not reality, were not the truth. And because they did not hold on to anything, did not grasp at anything whatsoever, that transcendent awareness emerged free and unfettered in them. And the void into which they entered, they discovered, was the plenitude itself. That plenitude is yours so long as you never grasp it. That is how they discovered. And they called that state the mindless state. The Upanishads, for instance, are full of this same phrase, this same word. Unto mindlessness they came. And in that they discovered the Supreme itself. The emptying of the mind that one talks of where meditation is concerned is not as if one took a bucket or something and emptied out all the stuff that makes up one's mind. It cannot be done that way. I know something about this. I've tried this kind of thing. You can't do it that way. You just don't hold on to it. You don't push it out. You don't fight against it. You take no sides. You just attend and let it be. And like the morning mist which vanishes with the rising of the sun, it just disappears. And this is very difficult to do. Very difficult to do. But start with the little things of everyday life. with the little things of everyday life. And you will find that if this sense of possessiveness, this grasping, is dissolved, then the isolated self and isolative self-consciousness dissolve with it. Then you are the true individual, the undivided whole in your own organic being, and you are also undivided from the one total reality. This is something the educational world does not realize as yet. You know, in the sphere of education, all these advanced ideas about education, they talk of the whole man, the individual. And of course, being good linguists and etymologists, they know that the word individual means the not divisible, the not split up. All right, but they still regard the person as a separate self. And they bend their efforts to the aggrandizement, the enhancement, the fulfillment of the separate self in terms of preconceived perfection, which is all nonsensical, of course. You see, this is where the mistake comes. They have smelt the trail, so to say, but they have only smelt it. They haven't seen the quarry yet. And then there is that supreme step which only the awakened man can see and take. Namely, that the wholeness of the psychophysical being is not the whole story of individuality, of individualization. That is arriving at full egohood. And then the complete relinquishment enables that fully formed ego to be in complete relationship with the totality. That is the true individual. He who has ceased to obtrude upon the universal process.